Well, good morning and hello again. Glad to be here. If I haven't met you yet, my name is Grant. I'm one of the pastors here, and it is my privilege to continue us in this series called The Collection of Curiosities. This morning, we're going to be looking at a topic that sort of started last week and will continue into this morning. And the idea of this entire series has been that we want to be a church where you can come with your curiosities, that we believe in being a place where you don't have to check your brain at the door. You don't have to have just a naivety of your faith. You can really dig in and explore our faith and ask questions. And so this morning, we're going to be looking at this topic of justice and where is God in the midst of justice. Now, just full disclosure, when we were putting this sermon series together, I was in a couple of weeks of school and then we had a baby, so I was off for a few weeks. And so I wasn't in the room when they were putting this series together. And I came back and I was like, all right, what's the new series? They were like, Collection of Curiosities, here's what it's about. I said, sounds great. Am I going to be a part of it? Do you need me? And they said, yeah, absolutely. We've got a sermon for you. It's on justice of God. And I was like, oh, thank you so much for that. And they're like, yeah, yeah, and it's also going to be on baby dedication weekend. And I was like, awesome. So like, there's just complete strangers in the room that don't know me very well as I talk about the justice of God. So I'm pretty sure the teaching team is getting at me for something. I don't know what I did, but we're going to jump into this topic today. And really the way that we've phrased this question and the way that we've decided to come at this is with this question of why do cheaters prosper? Why do when we look around the world and we see people that we go, we know they're cutting corners, we know they're doing evil things, we know that they have done evil things, and yet they continue to prosper. Meanwhile, some of you may be going, well, but I'm following God and I'm trying to do the right thing and follow after him and I'm just not getting any breaks. Why is it that the cheaters are prospering and I am not? God, if you're really a God of justice, then where are you? And throughout history, we've tried to approach the answer to this question in a few different ways. One way to maybe approach it would be intellectually with just logic. And so the way that's sort of gone is you can break people down into four camps. There's some that would say neither God nor evil exists. This was put forth by Nietzsche, and this was what he argued for. And the reality is most people don't really buy into this one anymore because they look around the world and they go, no, 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 evil definitely exists. And so we can't say that neither God nor evil exist. But if that's not the case, then some move into the camp of saying that evil exists, but God does not. This is sort of the atheistic modern humanism, some mainline Buddhism, some Zenism. This is what they would adhere to, that evil exists. You just look around and evil is clearly there, but God doesn't exist. God is just a figment of people's imaginations. God is some being that people have made up to cope with the evil that is in the world. But if you're not in that camp, maybe you're in the camp that says God exists, but evil does not. Some of your less mainline Buddhists believe this, pantheism, Hinduism. The idea here is that God is everything and everything is God. And so nothing is essentially or intrinsically evil. Evil doesn't exist. God exists. And evil just is, and because nothing can be intrinsically evil. And then there's a fourth camp. That camp says God and evil exist. That we believe in God and that God absolutely exists, but so does evil. But just because you land in this camp doesn't mean that you're necessarily a Christian. Because there's some in this camp that would define it this way. They said, if God desires to prevent evil, but is unable to, so he is impotent. Yet if God is able to, but does not, then he doesn't desire to get rid of evil, so God himself must be evil. And they take it so far to say God exists and evil exists, and because God doesn't do anything about it, then he must be a monster or a beast or maybe even the devil himself. And Joel touched on some of this last week when he talked about suffering. But those of us that follow Jesus in the room, we would say, yeah, God and evil both exist. But we believe in a God that has so perfectly, in a way that only he could, taken all of his grace and all of his justice, and he balances them perfectly in infinite wisdom, and sometimes in ways that we don't understand. And I would argue that if we're going to deal with this question of why cheaters prosper, we have to begin right here. We have to admit that God exists. Because without God, there's really no way to define what is just and unjust. We were left trying to figure out who is the judge and who can step in and define justice and injustice. Only God, the Creator himself, can do that. In fact, this is what the great thinker and once upon a time atheist, and then he became a Christian, a man named C.S. Lewis, he wrote this. My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I gotten the idea of just and unjust? What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? After all, if the evolutionary process was solely responsible for life, it meant that there was no such thing as universal justice, only things that were personally beneficial for me. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies. Consequently, my atheism became too simple. See, where C.S. Lewis came to and where we have to begin is saying if we're going to answer this question of why do cheaters prosper, we have to begin with saying God exists. And as the Creator, he alone can even help us begin to find an answer for that. But then we still ask the question. We still ask, why do cheaters prosper? And for some of us, that's an intellectual argument that we go down, but for others in the room, this isn't intellectual at all. It's deeply personal. Because this year you buried a child, and no parent should ever have to do that. Because this year you've been diagnosed with cancer, and you're looking at the world and going, God, wait, I have been pursuing you my entire life, and I have gotten this diagnosis, but I see people that are not pursuing you, and they don't. God, where's your justice in that? Or you've been abused by someone in your past, and you're watching them move on and prosper, and you're still there, and you can't sleep at night, and you're begging of God, God, bring your justice. Or your family is falling apart at no fault of your own, and you are waiting for God to intervene. You see, we could approach this question from strictly an intellectual spot. And for some, that's what we need. But for others, this is so deeply personal. And you're in a season, and maybe it feels like it's been a long season, where you're just sitting there before God, looking at him and going, where are you? Because there are things happening in my life that don't make sense. And if you're a God of justice, why don't you do something? Show up, God. Prove to me that you exist. You see, for some, answering the question, why do cheaters prosper, is deeply personal. And so we have to come at it from both angles. But I would submit the reason that we even ask this question, the reason that we even begin to think about this idea of justice, is because we don't like grace and we crave justice. That at the end of the day, most of us in the room, if we were honest, would say we don't really like grace. Maybe put it another way. I really like grace for me and justice for you. But if I was to turn that around and be asked to extend grace to you while I received justice, all of a sudden, I don't like grace very much. And I really don't like justice either. But we live in a culture that really, it doesn't like grace. It doesn't lean that way. It craves justice. In fact, if you grow up in the American education system, most of us did, and we stand up every single morning at the beginning of school, we place our hand on our hearts and we say, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. You see, my entire life, I've been taking a pledge to justice. And so I am bent towards justice, which is why when I see God giving grace to other people in their life, it rubs me all sorts of the wrong way. Because after all, this justice is what I crave. We're going to look at a passage this morning in the Old Testament. If you've got your Bibles, you can open them up to 1 Kings chapter 21. In the Old Testament, the entire Old Testament is really basically a history of the Israelite people, the Jewish nation. And part of their history is that they were slaves in the land of Egypt, and then they were delivered out of slavery by God, who used a man named Moses to do that. and they set up their own kingdom, and they were following God as their king. And then at some point in their history, they looked at God and they said, "We don't really want you as our king anymore. We want a king like all the other nations around us." And God capitulated to their demand, and he gave them a king. And in 1 Kings 21, we're going to meet a guy named Ahab. Now, Ahab, he is the seventh king of Israel. And Israel's had some really good kings, and they've had some bad kings, but Ahab, he's the worst king that they've had to this point. His reign is going to be in total about 23 years, and we're entering into the story during his 20th reign. And part of the reason that Ahab was an evil man is that he wasn't following God. So much so that he went and married a woman named Jezebel, and Jezebel wasn't following God either. In fact, she followed other gods of other cultures around her, and she brings those into Israel, and she sets up places of worship for them, and something over 150 prophets of other gods come into the nation, and Ahab begins to follow after them as well. So God comes to his prophet named Elijah, and he asks Elijah to give some bad news to Ahab, and he gives bad news to him, and Ahab doesn't like that, and then they go their separate ways. And it's right about here that we're going to pick up the story. 1 Kings chapter 21, starting verse 1. After this, the following episode took place. Naboth the Jezreelite owned a vineyard in Jezreel adjacent to the palace of King Ahab of Samaria. Ahab said to Naboth, "Give me your vineyard so that I can make a vegetable garden out of it, for it is adjacent to my palace. I will give you an even better vineyard in its place, or if you prefer, I will pay you silver for it." But Naboth replied to Ahab, "The Lord forbid that I should sell you my ancestral inheritance." Let's just stop there for a moment. You see, Ahab being king, he's in his palace at this point, but he has a spring palace in the city of Jezreel. He's got a summer home, if you will. And while he was there the past summer, he noticed that there's a vineyard next to his palace that would make a great vegetable garden. And so while he's away, he sends word to Naboth, who owns this vineyard, and says, "Hey, I'd love to make a trade. I'll give you a better vineyard. I'll pay for it. Like, well, like, let's make a deal here." And Naboth says no. But when he says no, he invokes the name of the Lord. And why does he invoke the name of the Lord? He invokes the name of the Lord because Naboth understands the law that was given to Moses that was passed on to the people as they came out of slavery. And in the books of Leviticus and in the books of Numbers, God gives Naboth the right to tell the king of Israel no. And Ahab seemingly understands the law as well because he goes back to his palace. He doesn't demand that Naboth give him the land, even though he is the king, which is again why we have to begin that if we're going to see where this story goes and understand why cheaters prosper, we have to begin where both of these men do and say, "God, sometimes you are up to things and doing things that I may not understand, but that doesn't clear the fact that you exist." So Naboth tells him no. And then the story goes on. So Ahab went from his palace bitter and angry that Naboth the Jezreelite had said, "I will not sell to you my ancestral inheritance." So Ahab lay down on his bed, pouted, and would not eat. Then his wife Jezebel came in and said to him, "Why do you have a bitter attitude and refuse to eat?" He answered her, "While I was talking to Naboth the Jezreelite, I said to him, 'Sell me your vineyard for silver, or if you prefer, I will give you another vineyard in its place.' But he said, 'I will not sell you my vineyard.'" Do you catch what's happening here? The king of Israel is told no. He goes home, he sits down to eat, and he goes, "Uh-uh. Nope. I'm mad." And he pouts like a little juvenile kid or something, and he whines and he complains and he refuses to eat, and he sits there with his arms crossed, laying down at the dinner table, and eventually his wife comes to him and goes, "Ahab, what is going on? Why won't you eat your food?" And he goes, "Well, because I went to Naboth and I asked him for his vineyard, and I was going to make him a fair trade, and it was going to be good for him and for me. And Naboth said, 'I will not sell you my vineyard.'" And then look at the next verse. Look at her response. Goes like this. Right? She like goes condescending. "Hey, will I give you your vineyard? You gotta be kidding me. Seriously, look at verse 7. His wife Jezebel said to him, "You are the king of Israel." get up, eat some food, have a good time. I will get the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite for you. And so Ahab turns and he eats, and his wife puts a plan in place. She sends word to the leaders of the city of Jezreel, and she says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to declare a fast in the land. And at the end of that fast, gather everyone together and have everyone sit down and break the fast with a mighty feast. And as you break the fast, take Naboth and put him in the middle where everyone can see him. But on his right and on his left, put some evil men. Grab some men out of prison that you have leverage on and take these scoundrels and have them accuse Naboth of blasphemy against God and blasphemy against the king. So the leaders of Jezreel declare a fast and they throw a feast and everyone sits down and Naboth is in the middle. And in the middle of the dinner, unbeknownst to him, something happens and the two men throw these false accusations against him. And the crowd hears it and they begin to riot and become a bit of a mob. And the Jewish law would state that if you have blasphemed against God and against the king, then you need to be taken out of the city and stoned. So they take Naboth, the innocent man, outside the city and they stone him. And they send word back to Jezebel and they say, Naboth is dead. And let me just again pause here for a moment. Because something that Jezebel is doing here that can't be lost on us is Jezebel is invoking the Mosaic code, the law of God, in order to get what she wants. She understands what this Israelite city believes. And she goes, ooh, I've got an idea. Let's declare a fast. That'll communicate to them that somebody in their midst has done something that God is upset with, and so his justice is about to come upon the city. Not only that, but they did it against his king as well, which will then give Ahab the right to go take his vineyard after he is dead. And so she is manipulating and using the system, using what God has set forth for her own gain. And God is not okay with that. The God that we serve is never okay when those of us in the church take what he has meant for good to guard us and protect us, and we use it for our own advantage. And we have to remember that because we live in a world right now where we see stories of priests taking advantage of children. And we see stories of pastors stealing money that people have sacrificially given to kingdom work for their own gain. And we see stories of women in the church that are afraid to speak up or to say anything because the men that have been in charge of their churches have made it so they can't say anything. And that grieves God. He is not okay with that. But just because someone is doing something in the name of God does not mean God is doing those things. It's still not right. And God will deal with them. But we have to just step back and go, this is happening in this text, and it's not okay. So Jezebel goes and she gives word to Ahab, and she says, get up. Naboth is dead. Take your vineyard. And Ahab goes, and he is on his way to take his vineyard. And on the way there, God comes to the prophet Elijah. And he comes to Elijah, and he goes, hey, Elijah, I have seen what Ahab and Jezebel are doing, and it is not okay with me. They're using my name in ways that it was never meant to be used. They've killed an innocent man and stolen his vineyard from him and his family. And there's another retelling of the story in scripture that says they didn't just kill Naboth, they killed him and all of his sons so no one could even claim the land. And so God goes, Elijah, here's what I want you to do. Go tell Ahab that my justice is coming. And here's what it's gonna look like. Ahab is gonna die. And he's not going to die a death that is good for a king. And he's not going to be buried like a king should be buried. No, his body is going to be laid outside the city. And the blood from his body is going to flow into the field that he just stole. And Jezebel, as for her part in it, she's going to die as well. And the way she's going to die is she's going to die inside the city. But she's not going to get a queen's burial. No, no, no. Her body is going to be left on the street. And by the time they get to it to try to bury it, the wild dogs of the city are going to have come and eaten the flesh and left nothing but the bones. Go tell Ahab that's what's coming for him. And just in case you hear that and you go, man, isn't God mean? Like, how could he do that? Like, that's gnarly. The author reminds us in verse 25 and 26 who Ahab is. There had never been anyone like Ahab who was firmly committed to doing evil in the sight of the Lord, urged on by his wife Jezebel. In fact, he was so wicked, he worshiped the disgusting idols just like the Amorites whom the Lord had driven out from before the Israelites. So the author goes, hey, just in case you've forgotten, Ahab is not a good dude. So any justice that's coming his way is deserved. So Elijah goes and he gives Ahab the news. And then verse 27 happens. When Ahab heard these words, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and fasted. He slept in sackcloth and walked around dejected. So he shows remorse, he shows humility. Then the Lord said to Elijah the Tishbite, have you noticed how Ahab shows remorse before me? Because he shows remorse before me, I will not bring disaster on his dynasty during his lifetime, but during the reign of his son. I'm sorry, what? You've got to be kidding me. This is the most evil king that Israel has ever had. He is allowing his people to worship other gods. He has just killed an innocent man that is following God and doing the right things and following the Mosaic Code. And Ahab just has just allowed him to be killed. And then he gets caught in it because God sees everything. And when he gets caught, he shows a little bit of remorse before God. And God goes, it's okay. I'm not okay with that. That rubs me all the wrong way because I crave justice. Ahab holds the highest position of authority in his entire country. And God goes, you've shown remorse before me. I'm going to give you grace. This is the kind of thing that should well up a righteous anger in us if we can keep from crying over it. It's the kind of thing that makes me want to go into the streets and start rioting. It's the kind of thing that makes me want to cuss. Because I look at God and go, where are you in that? God, where is your justice in all of that? Because the story ends there and Ahab goes on with his life. And just in case you're going, yeah, but is that really grace? Isn't that just cheap grace? It is. In fact, after this, we see no recollection in all of history that Ahab turns and begins to follow the Lord. We don't see anywhere that he goes and tears down all of the false gods and temples and idols and begins to chase after God. He doesn't go to Jezebel and say, hey, we need to begin to continue after God because he has shown me grace. No, he takes part in cheap grace here, and God seems to be okay with it. That is a kind of overwhelming, never-ending, reckless kind of love that, quite frankly, I don't like, if I'm honest, because I want justice. Let me maybe even rephrase that. I'm okay if justice comes later. What I want is immediate justice. This man has been caught. He has done something that he shouldn't have done. He is the king of Israel, and God extends grace? No, where's the immediate justice, God? But as I ask that question, I have to kind of pause for a moment and play that out and go, okay, wait a minute. Am I really comfortable with God's immediate justice? I mean, just say theoretically that we could gather up all of the evil people in the world, right? And put them into one prison and go, all right, you are all here. All the evil people are there. Now we are going to judge you accordingly and we are going to enact immediate justice as a society. Who has the right to judge any of them? Who can weigh appropriately who is in the prison and who gets out of the prison? Not only that, but would any of us be willing to volunteer and go, yeah, I should probably go be in that prison. Like I'm there. No, what we would do is begin to compare ourselves to one another and be like, well, I mean, I'm evil and bad and I've done some things, but I haven't done what you've done. I mean, everybody, have you seen what this guy did? I mean, listen to him. This gal, I saw her doing this thing. No, we would immediately start to keep ourselves out of that. Which is why the only one that can really wield the sword of justice perfectly and mightily should be God. because as creator, he is the only one with infinite wisdom, infinite grace, and infinite justice. And so that's why I don't like it, but I have to step back and go, okay, wait a minute, God, maybe you're up to something here that I don't understand. That's why later on in the New Testament, one of the authors named Peter would write that the Lord is not slow concerning his promise, as some regard slowness, but is being patient toward you, because he does not wish for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance. You see, the God that we serve is more loving, more kind, more gracious, and more willing to give second chances and third chances and fourth chances than most of us are really comfortable with. That is the grace of God. And so what do we do with that? How do we today sit with this amazing grace and live with it? I think the first thing that we have to do is let grace overwhelm you. We have to sit back and say, God, let your grace overwhelm us. God, your grace is so big that I could never even understand it. Your grace, God, your grace is gargantuan, and here I can't understand it. In fact, it even shocks me. So just overwhelm me with it. Let me sit in it and participate in it and be a recipient of it, because God, I don't deserve it, yet you give it to me anyway. Maybe I could illustrate God's grace for you in this way. Imagine there's a city that has an amazing fire department. This fire department is so amazing that as soon as they get the call that a fire has started, they're able to get there quickly and put it out before any real damage has been done. But the fire department looks up one day and goes, okay, well, wait a minute. We keep just putting out the fires. What if we could help prevent fires? And so they pass a fire code. And they pass the code and they hand it out to everyone in the city and they say, hey, here's the law around the fire code. And this isn't to put rules around you. This is to protect you from being in a fire. And so everybody begins to look at the code, and then they go, well, wait a minute, we need somebody to help us enforce the code. And so let's create a fire marshal. And so a fire marshal steps in and starts going around to all of the businesses and checking on the code to make sure that they're doing what they need to do in order to prevent fires. But there's one businessman who he just doesn't seem to care about the fire code. He keeps just breaking it over and over and over and over. And so the fire marshal shows up and the fire marshal writes him up and turns it in. And the first time it's a warning, and the second time it's a warning. And then the third time they start fining him. And they start fining him. And at first he pays the fines. But then eventually he just quits paying the fines altogether. He just shows no regard for the fire code whatsoever. And so he's not paying his fines, and then he gets self-righteous about it and goes, well, who are they to tell me what to do? So he sues the city for the code that they have put in for his protection. And in the middle of that litigation, his business catches on fire. And that a fire department comes rolling up to his place of business, and they jump on the truck and they grab the hoses and they look and go, nope, not that one. We may be the best fire department in all the land, but that guy had this coming. In fact, I kind of hope he's inside. That would be justice. But the way that we have defined it, and if the fire department did that, we would all not be okay with that, because we're going, no. You're the fire department. Your job, who you are, your essence is to put out the fire. And so that's what the fire department would do. They would show up, and it wouldn't matter how many times the guy had broken the code, they would put out the fire. But then in the middle of the fire, it gets huge and the fire starts raging, and one of their men dies in the fire. And then they go to the owner of the business afterwards and they say, hey, we know that you're going to have to deal with insurance and litigation and all of this stuff afterwards. And so, hey, here's what we want to do. We know that you have all of these fines and this cost that's up. So as a fire department, we would like to write a check to pay for all of that. He would look at them and go, that doesn't make sense. They would go, yeah, we know. It's called grace. You see, when we understand that kind of grace, it overwhelms us. Which is why, again, the New Testament says in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21, that God made the one who did not know sin to become sin for us so that we could become the righteousness of God. God showed up and he said, you've been breaking the law all over the place and starting fires and setting fires, and I'm going to come in and I'm going to die for you as I put out the fire. That's a grace that I go, that doesn't make sense to me, God. I'm not worthy of that. I haven't earned that. I don't deserve that. And he goes, I know. So when I look up and I go, well, God, why are cheaters prospering? He goes, because I am slow to anger and abounding in love. And I'm extending grace to them in the same way that I have to you. And I know you may hear this and immediately go, whoa, 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 wait a minute. If God's grace is that big, then what's the deal with sin? And if sin can increase and grace increases, then let me just go on sinning and not give regard for God whatsoever, which is why Paul in Romans goes, hey, I'm glad you asked that question. He says this, what shall we say then? Are we to remain in sin so that grace may increase? Absolutely not. May it never be. Are you crazy? How could you even think that way? How can we who died to sin live in it? You see, when we understand the grace of God, it doesn't just cause me to want to not sin. It leads me to not sinning. It leads me in my own way and in my own journey, in my own time, to see things as the way they are and go, God, your love is so big for me. How dare I take advantage of that? We have to let God's grace overwhelm us. And as we allow his grace to overwhelm us, we'll be face to face with it. And one author that I read that it was so good, he said it this way. He said, grace uses no tricks, no carrots. It just dies for our life. That is no doubt more unfair to all concerned than any tit for tat arrangement that the world would ever make. But it is the only way we get to live. If we saw grace clearly, we would cry our eyes out over the sadness of it. But that is how it is. Our joy comes by another's blood and from wounds that we open all of our lives. So grace overwhelms us. And as it does so, I'm left to sit there and realize that I am a cheater, that I need grace. But as it exposes that I have cheated in life, it doesn't condemn me in that moment. It extends a hand of love and of care in that moment. So I begin to look over my life and go, oh my gosh, I have cheated people and manipulated people and lied to people and stolen from people and presented myself in a way that I am not so that I could be shown in the best light. I too am a cheater. So I better be careful about wielding the justice stick because I'm a cheater as well. And even for me, as I look at that and go, okay, well, yeah, I mean, I'm a cheater, but I haven't killed anybody. Like Ahab, like he's king, he's highest position in the land, he should know better, we should trust him more. Like he just killed a guy, like I'm not that bad, God. And he goes, you're right. But people before you have done evil things and have killed people so that you could benefit from it. So maybe I'm not participating in my own cheating, but I'm participating in theirs. And I know that to be true because I sit here before you as a white middle-class male. Right, and those are three things that in our society have given me privilege that other people would long for and want for, and it's because people before me set it up that way. And I sit here and go, I can't apologize for that. I had nothing to do with my socioeconomic status, the color of my skin, or the gender that I was born. But instead of trying to apologize for it, maybe I need to become aware of it. And as I become aware of the way that I personally have cheated and benefited from other people cheating, you know what that does? It leads me to become an overcomer. It leads me to want to overwhelm other people with grace. And so I need to be an overwhelmer. I need to look around me and go, okay, wait a minute, that which has freely been given to me, I need to freely give to other people. And so the grace that I have received and benefited from, some that I have earned and some that was just simply given to me by nothing I did, I need to then pass that grace on to others, which means I need to begin to assume the best about people. Assume that they're not out to get me, but lead with questions and get to know them and be inquisitive about what's going on in their life because they may be hurting. It means that I no longer hold grudges against people. It means that I forgive 7 times 7 times 7. It means that I no longer keep score with coworkers and with my spouse. And whenever they do something to me, I don't go, well, you know, last time I did that, you came in with that justice stick and you beat me down. So guess what? Now it's my turn. No, I extend grace. I give them grace because I have received it. So why would I not want to give it to other people? It's when moments like coming up on October 20th come about and you can see there's this organization called Compassion Connect in our community, and they hold these clinics, and they're medical and dental and social service clinics for people to come that couldn't afford it, and there's an opportunity for all of us to go and to volunteer at these. And to go, people are going to walk in the doors that I disagree with on so many different things, but here's an opportunity to go serve, to extend a hand of love and care and grace to them. It means that I step back for a moment and realize that grace is what I need to be a dispenser of, because I crave justice and I'm going to continually be drawn back this direction. So let me fight hard for grace, because justice is easy for me. Grace is much more difficult. And so we need to be overwhelmers. But then there's one more thing. One more thing that I would be totally remiss if we didn't take a moment to talk about. And that is that some of you in this room have been cheated by people. Some of you have had people that are above you in authority and power in some way, shape, or form, and they have abused that authority. They've abused that power. They have cheated at your expense, and you're sitting there watching them continue to prosper and move forward while you feel stuck in this thing that was done to you. And you're sitting there crying out for justice and going, God, where are you in this? Because I have been cheated and they are moving forward. So God, what do I do with this? I don't know what your story is, and I don't pretend to understand it. What I do want to say is I'm sorry. Those things never should have been done to you. You should never have been put in that position. People should not take advantage of other people just because they can. And that grieves the heart of God, and it grieves my heart, and it grieves the heart of this church. And so we have a care ministry, and we have pastors on staff that would love nothing more than to come alongside you in your pain and in your suffering and say, let me extend grace to you as well. We love you. We see you. We believe you. How can we help? And as you sit in that moment, I want you to know that we serve a God that understands that pain. He understands what it means to be cheated. Because Jesus Christ, fully God and fully man, came and he dwelt on this earth and he walked among us and he lived among us, and people eventually came along and they falsely accused him of a crime that he never committed, nor could he have committed. And they falsely accused him. They set up a false trial where the witnesses were against him from the get-go, and he was found guilty. And then he went and he hung on a cross with a thief on either side of him. And in that moment, he cried out to God and he said, have mercy on them. They don't know what they're doing. In his darkest hour, he still extended his grace. We serve a God that understands your pain, that understands your suffering. And he wants to extend grace to everyone in the perfect ways and in ways that only he can. Which is why I love the old hymn. Grace, grace, God's grace. Grace that will pardon and cleanse within. Grace, grace, God's grace. Grace that is greater than all of our sin. Pray with me. God, I just come before you and I thank you for your grace. I thank you that you are a God that loves us, that cares for us, that extends grace to us in ways that we cannot understand and don't even have to. But we thank you for it. It's in the name of Jesus that we pray this. Amen.